Today we'll continue in our series, Coming to Jesus, reading from John chapter 14, verses 1 through 14. Precious text, one you've often heard at funerals, but I just ask you to remember that the context immediately given here, the disciples, while Jesus was cueing them into his own death, they were not seeking comfort for dying themselves. That wasn't really in their purview. And yet they were in a dire position, needing comfort, and Jesus was apt to give it. The immediate context was Jesus' incredible love and humiliation demonstrated in the foot washing, followed by Jesus' prediction that Judas would betray him, followed by Peter's denials that Jesus predicted. You can imagine there's quite a bit of heaviness in the room. And that is the context, not a funeral. And if there is one, then it's Jesus' funeral that's in view. But that's the context for these words. And it begins so preciously, John 14, 1. Please hear the word of the Lord. Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. And you know the way to where I am going. Thomas said to him, Lord, we don't know where you're going. How can we know the way? Jesus said to him, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. Philip said to him, Lord, show us the Father, and it is enough for us. Jesus said to him, have I been with you so long, and you still do not know me, Philip? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Do you not believe that I am in the Father, and the Father is in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does his works. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or else believe on account of the works themselves. Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever believes in me will also do the works that I do. And greater works than these will he do, because I am going to the Father. Whatever you ask in my name, this I will do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If you ask me anything in my name, I will do it. This is the word of the Lord. Last week, I talked quite a bit about Peter. And some of you might have thought that was a bit too much. And maybe it was. But we wouldn't have had to spend any time on Peter whatsoever if he simply hadn't put his freshly cleaned foot so deeply into his own mouth. Right? Plus, Peter got us talking about someone else by the end. Peter Whitman, that is. If you stayed for our ABF study after church, and you should consider doing so, Peter Whitman got the attention off of his namesake for a while by taking it out on Pliable, a fickle or fussy character from Pilgrim's Progress. Now here's a quick quiz for those who were here. Which parable of Jesus did Bunyan connect Pliable's speedy fall from faith with? Which parable? Mother, my mother gets first priority. Everybody, just... The sower, and she was right. Phew! Would have been awkward. The sower. Now, I want you to pay attention. I'm going to make a connection here. Now we'll get there. Listen to how Matthew 13 relays that parable that then Bunyan connects with Pliable. Matthew 13, 21 to 22. The seed sown on rocky ground is the person who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. But he has no root in himself and does not endure. When trouble or persecution comes because of the word, immediately he falls away. He falls away. The word underlying there, scandalizo, it sounds like our scandal. It's a word that means to cause to stumble, to give offense, or fall away. One theological dictionary says it refers to the experience of being offended or tripped up that could cause falling away from the right path. Now, that verb, if it's used in the active, you would be the one giving offense. You would be the one causing someone to fall. You could be the one causing to stumble. But as is often the case, it's given in a passive tone, which means the actions being done to you. You are caused offense. You are made to stumble, or you fall away. And when the New Testament uses that in the passive sense, another lexical dictionary says here, it carries the sense of falling away, as in to apostatize. I don't know if you know what that word means, but apostasy is not a good word. You can look it up later. But falling away, apostatizing, that is heavy. Okay, so now let me connect some dots. Back to Peter now. Because we really do risk missing a key observation if we obsess about his unique failure. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all record Peter's particular denials of Jesus and in a very unflattering light. And yet, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John recognize that Peter was not alone in his failures. Let me show you this. And consider the language of the other Gospels. So I'll start with Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Matthew and Mark use this same verb, this same language, for falling away, which again, in its strongest sense, carries the note of apostasy, falling away. Matthew 26, 31. This was after the Passover meal. Jesus said to them, "This night you will all fall away because of me. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered." He quotes there Zechariah 13, 7. Mark 14, 27 says the same thing. Jesus says, "You will all fall away." All of them. There's no one lifted up here. Peter is really a representative of the whole. In Luke's gospel, Luke 22, 31 to 34, that language of falling away isn't there, but the same weight of concern is there. Luke 22, 31 to 34. And here, something has caught my eye that hasn't before. You are probably familiar with the phrase, "Simon, Simon, behold, the devil has desired or demanded to sift you like wheat," right? What you may not have known, and I didn't know either, because again, unless your English Bible has a really good set of translator notes, you don't know when that "you" is singular or plural, because the Bible doesn't translate "y'all." Someone should come up with a Southern version Bible. How has this not happened? If that would be fixed, we'd have the plural. Because "y'all" is here. The New English Translation, it adds Simon's name at key points and it expands things. It makes it a little more dynamic here so that you can pick it up. The New English Translation is fantastic for revealing to you what's in the original. "Simon, Simon, pay attention. Satan has demanded to have you all." There's the plural. Isn't that interesting? Satan has demanded to have you all, to sift you all like wheat. But I have prayed, and now it's the singular four times. There is a unique focus on Peter. But I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. When you have turned back, strengthen your brothers. Needless to say, although Peter's failing across all the Gospels was pointed out particularly, he was by no means alone in his failure. Come to think of it, the only one who was really alone on that fateful night was who? Jesus. And yet, because he was with the Father and in the Father, he was still not entirely alone. John 16, 29 to 33 relays this. And now you see how it's, even in John's gospel, it relays that Peter is a representative of the whole of that group. John 16, 29 to 33, his disciples, so Jesus is continuing this same dialogue which stretches all the way to chapter 16, 17 into the prayer. His disciples said, "Look, now you are speaking plainly and not in obscure figures of speech. Now we know that you know everything and do not need anyone to ask you anything. Because of this, we all believe that you have come from God." Jesus replied, "Do you now believe? Look, a time is coming and has come when you will be scattered, each one to his own home. And I will be left alone. Yet, I am not alone because my Father is with me." You see, all this to say, this is about a lot more than Peter. The disciples here are on the cusp of failure, of leaving Jesus alone on his loneliest night. Jesus has now told them plainly about it. And just imagine what is happening in the room. What's the vibe? This is supposed to be Passover. This is a special celebratory time. Even if there's elements of it that are solemn, it's a celebratory time. The time where we came out of slavery. We were made provision for. We were covered over. We were protected. But in this room, everything's falling apart. I don't think that's an exaggeration. What do you think was going on in their hearts? Judas has left the building, not just metaphorically, which we don't know how early that happened. Maybe he never entered the building. But Judas has left the building. Peter is beside himself with confused zeal. The rest have pained, doubtful expressions on their face because Jesus not only told them they will all fall away, but to add to that, he said that he himself is going away. Okay? Star player of the team, captain of the team, and he's leaving. And it's not like it's going great with the rest of the squad. So now on this festive day at Passover, chaos reigns within their hearts. But that is not Jesus' goal. Jesus' goal is not chaos, not in the world, not in your heart. That's not his goal. And yet the world is chaotic and our hearts are chaotic. Jesus' goal is that he, the Christ, would reign supreme in their hearts and ours. As we've seen before, lest we blame Jesus for sort of causing all this turmoil, as we've seen before in conversations with Jesus that kind of took this tough dialogue, it seems like things were going great and then Jesus makes it bad. But Jesus doesn't make it bad. He just reveals how bad it really is. He pulls that wallpaper back. It's like, oh, that wall is moldy. I did not realize. But the mold was still there. It's not, you don't get blamed for the mold because you pull the wallpaper down. Jesus doesn't create distance between himself and either existing or would-be followers. He only reveals the chasm that's already there so that the space between us and him can be observed and then bridged by him who provides a way. He who is the way, he's the way. So that's what's happening in this dialogue. It's not that Jesus made the disciples who were otherwise calm and relaxed restless, but he only revealed the fact. And he offered them to trade their restless hearts for his rest. That was his trade. So rather than berate them on the points of their failure right now, rather than make a huge deal of their extreme failure at a pivotal time, rather than harp on that and bring added guilt and added shame, Jesus does reveal it. He does point it out. He does let them see it. But then what does he do? He says what really God can only sanely, safely, meaningfully do. He can come in and say, "Don't be afraid." Other people might say that, and really we're thinking, you have no business saying that. You have no ability to change my situation. You have no reach here. Who are you to say, "Don't be afraid"? But Jesus, as God, he can say it. He can actually walk in to that trouble. And the trouble that's described there, it's the same word for his trouble that he's been experiencing. The trouble at his hour. The trouble at Lazarus' tomb. The trouble at Judas' betrayal. Jesus had experienced this trouble, but he's not trying to share it. He's actually trying to shield it from them. He's got to bear this trouble, but he relents for them. He has mercy upon them. He shields them. He's dealing with all of this, and he says, "But let not your hearts be troubled." It's actually the same thing in that other text that refers in John, that we were in before, John 16. When 16:32 had spoken of all of them leaving Jesus alone. Again, he didn't harp on how disappointing they were. You know, you guys, been teaching you for 3 years, and you're going to disappoint me so much. The very next thing he does in verse 33 is what? "I have told you these things because I love making you miserable." No, "I have told you these things to keep you stuck in your ways." No, "I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace." Isn't that remarkable? Can we just fathom for a second what it would be like? Be it friendship, marriage. What would it be like to know your friend or your lovers their next failure before they do? What would that be like to stand before them knowing their next failure and to choose to seek peace for them? "I know how you're about to disappoint me. Let not your heart be troubled." Isn't that incredible? Why should their hearts not be troubled? The things that Jesus has described are pretty troubling. It seems like the perfectly appropriate reaction, let's be honest. I'm not going to relay all those things that are going on again, but just think about it. It seems like the only right thing to do, but Jesus says, "Don't do it." And then he gives them some reasons for not doing it, for not focusing on themselves. And he gives us one of the sweetest comforts that's given in Scripture, which is part of the reason it shows up at so many funerals at a time where the thing we so desperately need is comfort. Comfort beyond what our eyes can see, what makes sense to us, what's immediately before us. We need a comfort beyond that room that we're in. With that person who's no longer there, we need a comfort for that. So what is the comfort? Well, verses 2 to 4 relay it pretty succinctly. It's a bit tricky connecting this with the rest of the text. But really, the bulk of the comfort comes in these verses 2 to 4, so I'll read them again. And it's about this place, and it's about Jesus preparing it. It's those two things. Jesus wants to tell them something that should comfort them. So he tells them about this place. Safe place, happy place. And then he tells them about his preparing it. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? In some translations, that's put forward as a statement rather than a question, which I think actually might be a bit better. If that's the case, it would read like this. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And then he continues, and if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. And then he says, and you know the way to where I am going. And some ancient manuscripts actually include here, you know the way to where I am going. Where I am going, you know, and the way, you know. So it emphasizes both elements in some manuscripts. In either case, it befuddles the disciples. First, before we dialogue with that confusion, if we even get time to get there, what exactly is this comfort? What place is so marvelous, so wonderful, that it can bring them out of the place they're currently in, their present misery? What place is so grand, so beautiful, so lovely to behold, so comforting, that it can draw them, lift them out of the place they currently are? I would say, however you go home with this, Jesus is speaking to them of an eternal home. An eternal home. An abiding home, an enduring home. It's a home that persists. It's a home that can't be touched. It can't be robbed. Can't be broken into. Can't be lost in a fire. Can't have a bad insurance claim against it. This is a safe house. An enduring, forever home. Happy, safe place that he's offering, that he's telling them about. Now, what is that place? You may not think there are options. It's just because it's so abundantly obvious, there's only one option he could be talking about. Many commentators think that's the case. I would ask you to consider, maybe, that there are more than one option, okay? If you leave home and you say he's crazy, that's fine. The first option is probably the most obvious. And again, part of the reason it's read at funerals, this text. What's the obvious answer? Okay, there it is. It's like you've all been to Sunday school or read the Bible. One commentator said it this way. The simplest explanation is best. So he did look at the other options. Simplest explanation is best. My Father's house refers to heaven. And in heaven are many rooms, many dwelling places. The point is not the lavishness of each apartment, but the fact that such ample provision has been made that there is more than enough space for every one of Jesus' disciples to join him in his Father's home. It's pretty sweet, right? And I think it's a fairly good description of the text. Depending on your version here, maybe you have here, there are many mansions. And down through history, people have entertained, you know, what's being put forward here is some type of strata of a housing development, and some of us are going to have mansions, and some of us are going to have townhouses, and some of us are going to have the other stuff. But either way, it seems to be in view is this long-term shelter for us. A facility for forever care. I think there's a lot of reasons in the text and in view of the rest of Scripture that render that a very faithful understanding of this text, that could completely encapsulate what Jesus is saying. Let's just think about that. If that's the case, why would this be such a great comfort to them? In this moment. I think that's where it gets a bit trickier if we make it this narrow. Again, they are not themselves facing uncertain death. And I'm sure they expected that Jesus, if he were to die, if his going away meant dying, that he would go to heaven. I'm sure they were rather confident about that. But why would it bring peace? Why would it calm their hearts in the present? For now, why is that? Well, I think that question is worth, you know, inviting us to consider other interpretive options. Let me try to give it its best. It was already pointed to in this commentary. The idea is that bearing in mind, Jesus has just, and we kind of take all the Gospels together as we have done this morning, Jesus has just told these guys, in a way that's a bit crass, but I think is kind of accurate, he's kind of told them, you guys suck. Right? The things that they're doing, the things that they're about to do, are extremely disappointing. And then he turns and says, but I have a home for you. I have a place for you. And it's not like a one-room apartment. Just one of you is going to make the cut. Or the one who doesn't deny me. It's got tons of room. How sweet is that to guys who are not just thinking about stressors in life and there's inflation and how's my family doing and the Romans. No. They're now having to think about their own failings and their failings of the Lord and not imagining that could be, but hearing it from their Lord who has been right about everything else. And now he's telling them, you're going to fall away. That's pretty heavy. So how great a comfort for Jesus to say, I've still got room for you. You guys in the room, there's no one else he's preaching to here. It's not like, oh, these guys are really going to screw up, but there's a chance for everybody else. They're the only ones in the room. The Gospels seem to make that clear. A lot of times Jesus is with a whole gang, but just the 12 were referenced. And of course, Judas, very sadly, has already left the room. But here they are. And Jesus tells them, you guys, you big losers, I love you. I got a place for you. It's got lots of room. And where I am going, even though you can't come with me now, I go to prepare a place for you. Not only that, but I'm going to come back for you. I will come back for you. I will not leave you stranded. You are not on your own when you see me go. I am still with you. I will come for you. That's a pretty big comfort. That's a pretty awesome promise at a time when you are thinking about your own present failing, for Jesus to pull you out and to think about your future. You think about your past and how it's muddy. You think about your present and how it's uncertain. But Jesus says, your future, if you are in me, that's locked in. No one's touching that. That's a place that I prepare, that I protect by my own doing. And I'm coming back for you to bring you into it. That's pretty sweet. I do think there's another option, which I told you about. And this one's a bit tougher to express, but I'm going to try. And that's this. It's that the home that Jesus is speaking of isn't really something distinct from him at all, but is him. Consider that with me for a second. It may sound clunky. You've maybe loved this verse your whole life as a thing that just spoke to you exclusively about the future, about your home in heaven. That's great. I don't think you should drop that. But consider, what if the home he's referring to isn't something distinct from him, but is him? Now, let me give you one textual defense of this, because that might sound like, oh, that's just esoteric nonsense. Jesus has talked about his Father's house before. In this text, he's talking about his Father's house, right? Is that what he says? Yeah, verse 2, in my Father's house. Has he said that before? Has he said that phrase before? My Father's house. Come on. Has Jesus talked about his Father's house before? Yes. The temple. Okay? So when he was talking about his Father's house there, he was talking about something that was there in the present. He wasn't talking about heaven. He was talking about the temple. What do you think the disciples would have been thinking about when he talked about his Father's house? A place with many rooms. What was the temple? The temple was the Father's house. The temple was the supreme place of God's presence among the people. It was the holy place. And on the room front, the temple is absolutely chock full, the whole temple complex, with rooms where his ministers, his priests would be. And who are these guys in Jesus' kingdom? His ministers, his priests. Interesting. What's even more interesting than that, because I don't think what Jesus is saying, okay, so let me not confuse you. I'm not saying Jesus is saying, don't worry, there's a temple over there. That wouldn't be much of a comfort because they've been kind of pushed out of the temple. Don't worry, there's a temple over there with a lot of space. No, he is talking about a temple that he's going to prepare. So again, go back to Jesus. This is chapter 2 of John. Verses 16 to 22. To those who sold the doves, he said, take these things away from here. Do not make my Father's house a marketplace. His disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will devour me or consume me. This again is the New English Translation. Zeal for your house will devour me. So then the Jewish leaders responded, what sign can you show us since you are doing these things? Jesus replied, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up again. And if we don't know what he was referring to, neither did the Jews. Then the Jewish leader said to him, this temple has been under construction for 46 years, and are you going to raise it up in 3 days? But Jesus was speaking about the temple of his body. So after he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the saying that Jesus had spoken. In light of that, in light of Jesus' own view about his body being the new temple, that people who would want to come to God would have to come to that temple and be in him to be in God's holy presence. In light of that, is it possible to consider that the comfort that Jesus is giving here is not just about a future one, but a one that's actually right around the corner that's going to reach them when Jesus is resurrected? That he's making a way through his very body, that he's preparing room for them in himself by going to the cross. Again, I know this is a bit tough to work with the text, but I think there are a lot of other reasons why this might be. But again, supreme among them is Jesus' own view about God's presence and where it dwells. Jesus has told them, I've become the dwelling place of God. You want to dwell with God, you dwell in me. To be with me is to be with the Father. So is it possible that when Jesus sang, let not your hearts be troubled, believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. That the facility that he's talking about forming for them is actually his resurrected self and their communion with him. Now again, I know some of you, that's going to be too big of a leap. You're going to say, no, you're crazy. It's just heaven. Just stop sweating it. It's just heaven. But like so many of the interpretations I've given you in John, when there's ambiguity about possible interpretations, John has often crafted his language such that we can and maybe should hold two things in tandem. And here, I think that is such a case. We should go to this text as a hope for a future home in heaven, but we should also realize that Jesus has made a home for us already. Okay, we are not homeless. That is a bankrupt view of the present Christian life. We are not homeless. And that's not just because we'll have a home one day, it's because we have a home now. And I think that is part of what Jesus was trying to express here and why it was such a comfort. They would have a home with him. And he talks about preparing a place. Now, again, think about if we make this a strict meaning. This is just preparing a place in heaven. What do we think that means? That he's going and like cleaning up the room. He's going making things nice and tidy. He's like reworking the artwork. The language here of preparation is tied with his going. I will go and prepare a place. If I go, I will go and prepare a place for you. So there is a direct connection with the preparation that is being made for us to have a home, an eternal home, connected with his cross. Because otherwise, there's no way home. There's no way home. But the cross makes a way home, which lends itself to the explanation when then Jesus starts talking about the way. And then they're confused about that, and they want to geolocate it. And, just give me the address, because these directions are not good. And Jesus says, the directions are fine, because I am the destination, and I am the way to it. I am the way, the truth, and the life. And they're like, what is going on? What are you talking about? He's saying, believe in me. Through the whole text, it's repeated. Believe in me. Believe in me, which is something you should not say unless you are God. Let's just set the record straight. Jesus came right out of the gates in this, using the same verbs in verse 1 for God as he speaks of himself, both either in the present or both as imperatives, which would be commands. He could be saying, you believe in God, you believe also in me, which at some level is true, though their belief in him needs to grow. Or it could be given the command. In either case, the verbs are the same for both. Believe in God. Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe in me. Whoa, that's a close parallel, Jesus, you're making there. And when there's any doubt about it, and the doubt comes up through Philip, well, just show us the Father and that'll be enough. He's like, aren't you getting it? Believe in God, believe also in me. I am saying two things, but I am saying one. Because I am the way and the truth and the life. And Jesus prepares that way through his going, through his death, and also through his rising and his life. Jesus is giving us the right to be somewhere we don't belong by going somewhere he didn't belong, to the cross. And now we get to have a home. We get to have a home today. We get to have a home forever. But that home is only in Jesus. There's no safe house. There's no safe shelter apart from him. There are many luring places that tell us they'll make us comfortable and make us at ease and make us feel at home, but there is no home for us apart from Jesus. He's it. Let me say just one more thing about Jesus being the way, because many have rightly recognized here that Jesus is making a very exclusive claim. He says, I am the way and the truth and the life. But then he makes that exceedingly clear by adding the negative element, and nobody comes to the Father except through me. So he's got the positive and the negative, just to make sure we're picking up what he's putting down. I'm it for you guys. If you're holding out for other options, kind of keeping your options open, that's not a safe bet. I am the way. Many have been bothered by how narrow that seems, by how narrow the way is. You're saying Jesus is the only way? But too few have considered how broad this way is. This way is broad enough to fit literally anyone upon. Sometimes we focus on the narrow way, that narrow door, and the rest of the way is broad. But it's like, who cares if a bridge is narrow if everyone can get over from Newport to over here? Yeah, sure, the bridge is narrow. Sure, it's the only way. But there's plenty of room on it to get over. Jesus may be the only way, okay? And he is. But there's plenty of room, which is echoed in Jesus' promise about the future, and I think the present, there is plenty of room. Many rooms. It's not an issue of vacancy with heaven. It's not an issue of vacancy with God. It's not an issue of vacancy with Jesus. There's plenty of room. The question is only, is there room in our hearts for him? But the way is broad. Anyone can go on it. Jew or Gentile, slave or free, male or female. What are the prerequisites for following Jesus the way? You must be a sinner. You must be a failure of sorts, as the disciples were predicted to be and were. Okay? I checked those boxes. I don't know about you. You must be a sinner, a failure. And then you must turn from the strange comfort that is your sin, and you must renounce whatever your claims of personal success, of having made it, of having made a home or built a home or made it your own. You have to be willing to renounce your claim to having arrived. You have to come before God with all your stuff and say, apart from you, I am homeless. And appeal rather to Jesus' sinlessness and his success. You must forego all earthly hopes and homes and hold to Jesus alone as your hope, your life, your home. Now, how do we get on this narrow way? This is pretty straightforward. Jesus says, you believe in God. Believe also in me. And that belief is going to be, that's going to mean something. It's going to mean something. It's going to make demands upon us, that belief. It's going to show itself up. It's going to be fruitful. Remember what Jesus says at the end of this dialogue. You're going to do the works that I've been doing, and greater works than these. If you're in me, you're going to ask God for things, and he's going to do things that blow your mind. This belief, it's going to do something. While the way is Jesus himself, and what he did on the cross is what he has done to bridge the gap between us and himself. The way we get on that way is by faith in him. It's as simple as it sounds, by faith in him. Persistent faith, not faith that never fails, but faith that never fails to come back, as the disciples did. Jesus has prayed. He had prayed for his disciples, and he has prayed for us to have a faith like that. Consider that. Jesus prayed that for Peter and the gang. And in John 17, we'll see it. He's prayed that type of prayer for us, that we will have a faith that endures. That we will have a faith, not that is complete without failure, but we have a faith that will keep coming back. That will never fail to hold Jesus alone as our hope and our home. And so, what do we do with this? Well, we keep coming to him. We come to Jesus once, and then we keep coming. We believe in Jesus once, and we keep believing. We do not fall away. And though we fall, we keep following him. Jesus, for his own part, in the face of everything and all the failure that surrounded him, he loved his own even to the end. And he loves us and will love us even to the end. So my urging would be, if you have not come to Jesus, if you're at home in this world, what does that compare to being at home with God? And if you have come to Jesus, keep coming. Keep praying. Keep coming to his word. Keep coming to church. Keep coming. To come to Jesus is not merely to have a home prepared in the heavens, but it is to truly to come home at the present. To be in Jesus is to be at home. And to work the works of Jesus is to work from home. So do so. Do his works. You're working from home. You are not homeless. He has given you a home. And yes, we have a glorious home awaiting us. Praise the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit who has made this way for us. Amen.